We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at
We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support, so if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by the lovely ladies from Three Mums, One Mission, ARFID. They are Michelle Jacks, Sarah Woodruff, and Jo Reed. They join me to share their experience of supporting their children with ARFID and the difficulties they face with the lack of recognition and the misunderstanding that's so commonly present with ARFID. We talk through each of their individual experiences, but this is just an intro to their experiences, and over the next few weeks we'll be diving in deeper with all three individuals to discuss their experience and to think more about how we can improve ARFID services so that people are getting the support that they need and deserve. Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast. I am very excited today because I do not just have one guest. I do not just have two guests. I have got three guests. So this is the first time I've ever done a podcast with four people. But today I am joined by Michelle, Jo and Sarah from Three Mums, One Mission, ARFID. So thank you all so much for joining me. How are you?
We're all right. I think we're all going to go.
Yes.
People then go, okay, there's definitely four people.
Amazing. Do you want to go around and introduce yourselves to start with?
Okay, so I'm Sarah and I have a daughter who had ARFID, but she had sort of late onset ARFID, so started in when she was 11.
Amazing.
My name's Jo and I've got a little girl called Echo. She's six and she has ARFID, and yeah, she just has always struggled with food, weaned fairly okay, but sort of from about 18 months, food was always an issue, and has been ever since. Very sensory sensitive as well to like smells, sounds, and the sight of food.
Thanks, Jo.
And I'm Michelle. I've got a son who is six with ARFID, and quite similar to Jo, Arlo, ever since weaning, has always had issues with food. And as time's gone on, we've kind of noticed a lot of his triggers is to do with being unwell. So as soon as he's poorly, the trauma of being unwell, just he drops all his food to the point we're currently not eating at all. So yeah, he's very up and down with his journey. And yeah, as much as all three of us are living very different situations, they're all quite similar in weird ways.
Yeah. And I imagine having each other is
extremely supportive and incredible when going through what you are.
Yeah, best thing that's ever happened for me is meeting these two.
Aww. Yeah, that's true. It's really hard. It's a hard journey to do on your own. And I think if we hadn't connected up on the Facebook group when my daughter was in hospital, I was losing the plot at that point. So that was great. You know, there was these two reached out and we just, it went from there really, didn't it?
Yeah. And I think we instantly just clicked. It's weird. I think, you know, ARFID is so different to everyone. It presents completely differently. You know, Sarah's daughter is a lot older than, you know, Arlo and Ethel. But when you're in that situation, just being able to talk to someone who understands, you know, the amount of times we've all messaged each other the most stupidest of things, or, you know, the world of social media, you get unkind comments sometimes. And I'm like, am I overthinking this? And they're like, no, you're full right to be thinking that. And it's just having someone that can understand. They're not going to pass judgment. They're not going to think you're crazy. We all just, yeah, we've been each other's rocks. I'll give it that.
Yeah. And advice from each other, because we've all tried different things. So like,
yes,
sometimes one of us might say, have you tried this? And then they're like, oh, I can't believe I've never thought of doing that. You know, so there's always, we're just always bouncing ideas of things, and what works for one of us might completely not work for the other one, and vice versa. But it's good to kind of just share knowledge and trial and error things that we've all, that, you know, that we always find ourselves in when it comes to ARFID.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I mean, I love it when I see you guys, because I genuinely, when I first met you, before I knew what you did, I thought, are they sisters? Because you all seem so close. And it's wonderful. I do think that obviously, you know, when you are navigating something like ARFID, particularly, you know, I'm probably making an assumption here, but there's a lot of people that don't understand ARFID. Therefore, yeah, you know, I can imagine when you're explaining to people what's going on, it can feel a bit like, you know, that disconnection, because they just can't rationalize what's happening. So to have each other is so incredibly powerful. And I wanted to ask, the sort of idea or mission, I guess, behind your podcast, how did that come about?
I think randomly all three of us was thinking about it, but none of us had decided to say it. It was weird. Like, I think it might have been Sarah. She was like, yeah, I've got a crazy idea. And I was like, I think I know what's coming. She was like, should we do a podcast? And I was like, why not? You know, there isn't many out there. You know, I've been on guests as as guests and things like that. But I think for the three of us, it was just to raise awareness, for someone to sit at home with a cup of tea and listen to something. And because we are so close, it's a lot more relaxed. It's not so staged. You can tell we're just having a natter. And I think if someone listens and then they feel better about themselves or not so alone, then we feel like our job's done.
Yeah.
I think it was just, we all felt so alone.
Yeah. I think that's exactly it. It was like, we were thinking, you know, we want to try and do a support group or, you know, something where we could help people. But obviously, as we're all busy mums working and looking after children and caring and everything, it's trying to find that time, isn't it, to set something up like that. And this was like the next best thing. We're like, well, we're always on the phone to each other. I was having a nap, so why don't we turn it into a podcast?
Just record it instead.
What?
Yeah. I think I tried to go around schools as well, hadn't I? So yeah, I'd written all these presentations and I'd managed to make it around sort of two schools to do. But I just found getting in to try to give them an awareness of it, they're so overwhelmed, schools, it just didn't work. And I thought, this is really frustrating, I kind of want to do something. And you know, local support group, I was like, well, is there going to be me in a room? You know,
no, doctor.
And the doctors are very accommodating in terms of like supporting either. They're very like, oh yeah, okay, you know, sort of thing, quite dismissive. So I think this was like, suddenly went, oh, why don't we just do this? Because actually, if just one person listens to it and feels a bit better, we've kind of achieved what we wanted to achieve.
And when we got that first message saying, oh, just listen to this, I can't believe that there's other people that understand what I'm going through, we were like, that's it. We've, you know, it's worthwhile. We've helped one person just feel, like you said, Sarah, feel less alone as we've all felt at times. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's that power of connection, isn't it? And I think, you know, it's possibly quite similar in terms of what people say about Full of Beans, in that when you're going through something, but maybe you're not quite sure what it is, or you're not quite ready yet to talk to somebody else about it, a podcast offers you that space where you can listen to it and nobody else knows that you're listening to it. And you build, you know, you resonate with what people are saying. You feel like, can't actually believe there's somebody else going through something as similar to me, or, you know, I thought that we were the only family that was experiencing this. To have that kind of, oh my God, I'm not alone in this. Yeah. But I also think as well, for you to have that protected space of when you do the podcast, it's like, we do just have to take a moment to reflect on what's going on and to talk about things, can be really, really helpful for your own processing.
Well, I definitely think it gives us a therapy session, 100%. I think, you know, with Christmas looming or any event or just anything that's going on, I think sometimes you massively overthink things. You try and plan everything to like military precision, but you can't do that, can you? Or like if you've had a bad day, just being able to offload. And yeah. I don't know, it just, you do come away feeling a bit lighter and not so heavy. And I think that's most probably why we chose to do the podcast. Like we had discussed before, maybe setting up a website, you know, doing support groups or things like that. But actually, there's so much that goes on behind that. And, you know, we are not just three parents, but do you know what I mean? We're just three mums. We was like, we don't have much of a background that maybe would solidify things like that. But a podcast can come from anyone. And I think actually coming from parents, I think it hits differently. You know, just that one conversation between us, all of us just go, oh God, I feel so much better. And I could just imagine someone sat there feeling exactly the same. It is like a therapy session.
Yeah. And even the silliest of things that, you know, you might think, oh, this is really, you know, not that important or whatever, but sometimes it might be really playing on your mind. And just to be able to talk to these two and say, actually, no, that's not silly. We've felt like that before, or, you know, it. Yeah, just that validation of having that friendship and support between each other.
I think as well with ARFID, you can end up with people making you feel like it's not real. So there's an awful lot of, it's just us eating, for goodness sakes. You know, if they came to stay with me, they'd eat. You're just indulging them. So I think that sort of feedback from other people can make you feel like you're going a bit mad. Yeah. And there's lots of parents who have years and years of this, especially from family, actually, I think, but also friends. And I think if you then find people that are saying similar things, you start to go, oh, I'm not going mad. I'm not, like, because you actually end up thinking, okay, I'm just making this up. This is just in my mind. There's nothing wrong, you know. And for me, we had years and years of gastro tests for my daughter, because I was absolutely convinced there was something, and I think there is something wrong anyway. Yeah. I was constantly told, nothing, there's nothing, there's nothing. And it was only when a psychologist actually said, have you ever heard of this? And she gave me the DSM-5. And I read it and I went, oh my goodness, like, no, I'd never heard of it. And suddenly it was like a bit of a light bulb moment. I was like, okay, maybe we're not all going mad. You know, but you do get a lot of negative talk from other people that will make you feel quite exposed as a parent and kind of, well, judged, really. So there's, you know, any sort of Facebook groups or this sort of forum is great, because it kind of gives that support.
Yeah And I would really like to, if we can, go through a bit of, you know, each of your individual experience. And I think what was really nice is actually the things that kind of wanted to ask each of you, you actually mentioned in your introduction. So very nice setting of the scene. I can tell that you're podcast pros. So in your introduction, Joe, you mentioned that your daughter, a big part of her issues, I guess, is the sensory sensitivities. And I wondered if you might like to share a bit more about that.
Yeah, Ethel has always found smells, sounds, like bright lights, all very difficult. So, for example, we might walk into somewhere and there may be a really lovely smell. She'll be like, what is that smell? you know, anything that's like a stronger smell, it could be a really lovely smell. So she's always been very sensitive about that. I could be sat eating like the least smelliest thing, like say a bowl of cereal, and she will literally be gagging next to me. So she's got a very sensitive gag, I suppose you would call it. So, you know, we have to be really careful about when we're cooking strong smelling things. It's always a bit of a risk. It's like, because at the end of the day, obviously we still eat dinner. And yeah, so she does struggle a lot with things like that. She's just very sensory sensitive. When we go out to eat, she'll quite often just go and sit on another table away from us when our food comes. Very rarely sits at the table with us when we're eating, which is fine because we've realized obviously that that's just the way she is. That's how she struggles with food. But it took a long time for us to get that recognized. And even though we went back to the GP, then we finally got referred to a dietitian, so cutting the long story short, then a pediatrician. It was back and forward, back and forward. Let's wait and see. Let's wait and see. Oh, well, she looks okay. She's you know, she's a good weight. She looks healthy enough. So, but she clearly isn't, because she was picking up and still does pick up every bug germ going. I always joke saying, oh, someone only has to look at her and she catches whatever they've got, because she gets ill so regularly. And that's clearly because obviously she doesn't eat enough food of the right things to keep her going. But again, it's just that same thing that we keep saying, you know, the pushback from medical professionals. And you are made to feel like that, like you're a failing parent, because you can't do the job that you're supposed to be doing, which is inevitably keeping your child fit and well, or keeping them alive, you know, keeping them healthy. And yeah, just to not have that sort of recognition until you've literally, you know, fought your way to try and get some sort of support. And even then, when the support, you feel like you've finally got something, it's very small. You know, there's hardly anything out there to support children that have got ARFID. We managed to get, luckily, a diagnosis through the NHS, which a lot of people don't get. And obviously it depends on the area and everything like that, whether you've got a pathway for ARFID. But even when that diagnosis came, I was like, thank goodness, finally, someone's listened to me. And this was from a very specialised paediatrician. So he knew what he was talking about. And we had a lovely conversation. I was like, thank goodness, somebody that really understands what we're going through and recognises the fact that she genuinely cannot eat food. You mean, you could offer her all the treats, same with Arlo. You know, you can offer all those delicious treats, cakes, sweeties. She's not interested. You know, it's not something that you can sort of buy their willingness to eat. It's that they genuinely cannot stand to try something. And I think that's the most heartbreaking thing for me, is we've got an older daughter as well. And, you know, you can buy her a nice chocolate treat, for example, and you can't get the same thing, because to her, that's not a treat. It's torture. So yeah. It's very hard.
Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for sharing. I think one thing I wanted to ask you, because you're obviously such a strong lady, and, you know, supporting your daughter with this, but you said something about, you know, coming to the terms with the fact that sitting at the table wasn't something that Ethel could do. And I guess for people listening that may be at the start of their journey, like, how did you kind of come to terms with that? Because I can imagine that's not an easy thing to sort of comprehend and explain to other people as well.
Yeah, no, it's not. And I look back and I'm ashamed, actually, of some of the things that I've tried, because before we knew that she'd got ARFID and realised that actually she does really have a problem with food, you know, we would try the whole, well, you can't get down until you've at least eaten this bit and this bit. You know, I know you're not supposed to do the whole bribery with pudding. We tried that. Doesn't work, obviously. giving just the same meal and being like, well, there's absolutely nothing else. You have to then just not have a look. You know, we've tried all of those techniques that doctors would say to us to do. We've prolonged snack times and meal times to try and get her more hungry. We've limited milk because she did used to drink milk. And yeah, it just got to that point where I was like, actually, this is not, what we're doing is not fair. Like, this is not, she's not reacting in the way that a typical child might react and be like, oh, actually, I do want my pudding, so I am going to eat my dinner. And it was hard. And I just said, you know, if she wants to sit in the lounge and not join us at dinner time, does it really matter? And then she may well eat one of her little snacks that she would be willing to accept, or one of her safe foods. Does it really matter? And I think the hardest bit was when we were around other people. It was it's fine when you're in your own little bubble, because as a family of four, obviously we know that that's what happens. That's our normal now. When you go to other people's houses or you have people around, and they see that that's, you know, she doesn't have anything to eat when we're eating. I think that's the hardest bit, is that even though they may not say something, you feel like you have to either explain, or that they might go home and be like, I can't believe that they didn't make a sit at the table. And I think as time's gone on and I've met these lovely ladies, I've realized I'm more confident. I will question people. I'll question medical professionals, which before I'd just, okay, thank you very much. See you later. Thank you. Okay. Whereas now I'm like, no, that's not good enough. Like, we need something. So yeah, I think it's just one of those learning curves that you have to just, you know, I've learned from my mistakes.
I think it's one of those things as well. There's a phrase that's like, you don't know until you know, or it's something like that. And I think it's very much exactly this experience. You know, I think as parents, you are encouraged to, you know, make your child eat their dinner before they have their pudding, or all sit at the table, can't leave the table until you've finished.
Yeah.
And there are things that are very much pressurized in society of how to support your child with eating. So naturally that, I guess, would be your response. And it's not until, you know your child best and you start to see those things aren't working, but then everybody around you who doesn't have the experience that you've had and hasn't had to sit there for the hours that you have, they'll be very quick to judge and say, yeah, that's wrong, or you shouldn't do that, or what have you. But that then just adds to the overwhelm and the pressure, making it a lot worse.
And the guilt. I think guilt is the worst thing. You know, I would love nothing more than to be able to sit as a family of four and eat a delicious meal together. But unfortunately, we've just had to accept that that's not how our little family works. And that's fine. You know, it's great that other people can do it, but we can't. Yeah, we've just had to accept that fact. And try not to feel guilty, even though, as much as I know, it's not my fault. It's not anything that we did wrong. I mean, time after time, we look back on things, but, you know, that guilt is always still there, deep down inside.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing, Jo. I have so many other questions, but I'm going to try and get round everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we'll have to get everybody on for a second episode individually. I think that might be a lovely idea. It's going to be a little warm-up. But I guess in your intro, Michelle, you mentioned that you and Jo had similar experiences, I guess, in terms of age. But I think you mentioned that Arlo isn't eaten at the moment. And I wondered if you would mind sharing a bit more about that.
Yeah, so Arlo's experience, as always, he's been very sensory since birth. It's the same as F4, really, always. In general, just hated like having his hair washed, hated mucky things and stuff like that, which obviously then affected his eating. And I think the first time he dropped all food, barring one thing, was when he had tonsillitis. And I was a bit like, okay. That's when we kind of then, Arfid became a bit of a light into our world. He then, a couple of years ago, had his appendix out. And I was always a bit like, okay, if he has anything major, we're going to lose that last one bit of food. And lo and behold, we did. He then just dropped to milk. So for about 10 months, he just lived off milk. And we was very fortunate that he had the supplement shakes. We kind of had like a 5-day warning from the hospital. You either drink these supplement shakes or you're going to have an NG tube. And I was like, he's not having an NG tube. You're drinking. And like Joe said, you look back and you do things that you most probably shouldn't do. And I will hold my hands up. I made Arlo drink them supplement shakes because I knew he would not manage an NG tube. So we did it gradually. I literally added like the most minuscule amount into his milk, you know, should never contaminate stuff, but I had no choice. You know, there was either have a tube up your nose or force him to drink it. Both directions aren't the best. So I was like, I've got nothing to lose. So we had 10 months of that. We then finally, after about 4 years of fighting with the services, got under a complex feeding team in London. And I knew what was coming. I knew that the only solution would be by giving him a peg. We'd got to the point, you know, he hadn't eaten for such a long time. And when they told us that, Arlo freaked. Not in the hospital. It wasn't until we come outside. He started screaming at my husband, I'm not having a peg. I don't want one of them. I'll eat. And we were like, yeah, of course, mate. Whatever. You're not going to start eating. So we come home and I was like, let's pick up an old safe food and let's try and wean a 5-year-old. And we was like, we don't know what we're doing. We'll give it a go. And actually it worked. We explained to him how his tongue worked, how my teeth worked, how the food changes in your mouth, the taste, the texture, everything. And gradually over time, he started to eat. We managed to get him back onto crisps. He started having yogurt again, wafers. And we were like, yes, we're on to a win. He then, 9 weeks ago, he now does have a peg. He's got a little tube in his tummy, which Joe's saying about the guilt. When you see a bit of plastic coming out of your son's stomach, that guilt is something I have never experienced. And I can't talk about it. It's awful. But we've noticed that as soon as he's unwell, everything drops. And the last week he's had like a viral infection. I had a cough, which I think I've passed on. So he's had it. And instantly I was like, we're going back to square one. And my husband was like, no, he'll be fine. And, you know, we'd managed to get him to have like a banana puree for breakfast. We'd decided with the dietitian, let's try and introduce new foods, but put them maybe not into a schedule. Sounds so strict. But we was like, maybe let's try and see if we can get him a bit structured as he's eating new things. So we managed to get him to have like a breakfast. We was doing like a pack of Pombears as like a mid-morning lunch and then another pack in the afternoon. Like it was working. And then as soon as he was unwell, it just all went. And more than ever, I can see the huge fear he's got of choking. And I knew he had a fear of food being in his mouth and a fear of swallowing, but it is so obvious now. I actually sent these to a voice note yesterday on the verge of tears because I was just like, no one's helping him. And the guilt's coming back up. I just think that I can't, how can I get him to feel that food's safe again? I think it's just, it's a whirlwind of emotions. I think so many people, you know, we've got neighbours and they've caught wind that obviously Arlo's got a feeding tube. We have nurses come around quite regularly. And, you know, a neighbour next door understands, but she said other people are like, well, my kid don't eat a lot, but they have chicken nuggets and chips and they eat fish fingers and they'll eat shepherd's pie. And I'm like, he does not eat. And they're like, yeah, of course he does. He must have Haribo. And I'm like, I'll give you £1 million if you can get this kid to eat Haribo. I will chop my leg off. I cannot get him to eat. It is not that simple. And now I'm like, do you want to know where he's fed? And he'll show people. He's not ashamed of it. He's done incredible. Considering he's so young, we were petrified of having it done because we didn't know how he would respond. He's been mind-blowing is almost probably the only way around it. He has taken it so well. It's made me stronger in terms of not feeling so crazy because at first I was like, oh, God, oh, just made me feel a bit sick. But he's doing all right. And I think it's just so hard. Now I'm back to square one. I did say to my husband this morning, I was like, I think we might have to gradually start seeing if we can re-wean him back onto food to see if we can kind of get rid of this fear of choking. It's just his brain is programmed as being poorly and food is connected. He's got this connect in his brain that as soon as he's unwell, he stops eating. And it's kind of, how can you stop that connection? It throws up so many emotions as a parent, hence why I'm quite tearful. Because it's intense.
Yeah, I mean, thank you so much for sharing, Michelle. And I think, you know, I can hear in your voice, as you say, how difficult it is. And I hope this is okay to ask, but I suppose maybe I'm coming from this from a naive perspective, because obviously having a peg is not a nice thing to have. Is that something that, because it does sound from how you've described it, that it's reduced the anxiety a bit for you because you're not having to kind of do the food stuff. And Arlo, you know, also isn't having to do the food stuff. Is that something that could be an answer? Or, I mean, as I said, it's not a nice thing to live with. What does it look sort of like in the future?
Do you know, it's really difficult because I think that was actually what my husband was worried about. He was like, would you put a tube in his tummy and he will stop eating? And we know he's stopped eating purely because he's not well at the minute. But even the dietitian, she's like, you've got to be very, very careful on how you go about it, because it could, over time, his brain could just go, well, I don't need to eat because, you know, mummy can feed me through my tube. So there is a very, very, very fine balance. And I think that's most probably the hardest thing with it. I think it's the knowing what's right and what's wrong. You know, even now when he's not being well, I'm like, should I put, what do I do? Like, I don't know. I'm forever ringing the nurses. They must be like, oh God, is Michelle again? But they're like, it's fine, just keep ringing. And I'm like, okay, I will speak to you tomorrow. Because it is, it's so much pressure. And actually, we had very little support before he had this peg. And actually, since he's had it, the support still isn't really there. And I think that's the hardest part about it. And I think that's what's hitting me the most at the minute. We've done a full 360 circle back to the same people that referred him to London in the first place, because obviously we don't live in London. We're now out of area. They've sent his care back to them to look after. And I'm like, but they wouldn't help me with him years ago. Why am I going back? It's just, it's very, it's hard to wrap your head around. I'm so grateful it's there. Like, we have made the right decision, and I know we have. But yeah, I don't really know what his future's going to look like. And so I don't know. It's quite sad. So I think, you know, I don't want him to grow up with it there forever. And equally, I can see his anxiety is building about the fact it is there. I think maybe he's had that realization that it's not going anywhere. And that hurts. I think that's what got me yesterday. I think he got really upset when I was doing it. And I was a bit like, you've just clicked. I think the penny had dropped that this is it now. Until, if anyone's got that magic wand out there, feel free to send it my way. Everyone wants their magic wands, right? Anyone wants to send it my way, please do.
I think everybody listening will be, you know, that magic wand is being sent your way. But I think from what both you and Joe have said, it feels, I mean, and this is slightly different, but I felt similarly with an autism diagnosis, in that you get the diagnosis, or there's, you know, you find out what the thing is, mm-hmm. but then there's actually nothing to help after that. And it's kind of, it's good to have that awareness, but it's then kind of like, well, now what do we do? Because now we actually know that there is something, but then almost feeling even more hopeless, because it's kind of just thrown back into your court of, okay, you know what your child is struggling with, but actually, yeah, where do we go from here?
And I think that's the thing with a peg. I do think, this is no shame on any services, but are they getting to the point where children are hitting crisis point because they've not been supported from an early age? You know, early intervention is key. They're not being supported when they need it the most when they're younger. That unfortunately, I'm hearing more and more and more and more kids are having feeding tubes because they're just at crisis point. You know, that parents are in and out of hospital, and then they're dehydrated, or they then find out that their blood levels, you know, everything just comes out when it's too late. And I just think, you know, I can't go back and think, oh, I wish someone had helped us years ago, because we could still be in the same situation. But there is a massive void in early intervention. I think we all agree. You know, for Sarah, obviously it was more late onset, but it's very similar in terms of still getting the support. I think the older you get as well, the support is a hell of a lot less than what it is for children. And we are unfortunate that there is nothing where we are to help support Arfid, hence why we've gone to London. But unfortunately, I still don't feel very supported. So it swings round in roundabouts.
Yeah, I think even when there is the support, it's still so minimum.
And
Sarah, you mentioned in your introduction that your daughter had experienced ARFID at a later point to Michelle and Joe's children. And I wondered if you wanted to just share a bit about your experience.
Yeah. So Grace started to have, she weaned really, really well. She was a brilliant eater. She had ate everything. I mean, she was incredible in comparison to my son, who's like the fussiest eater, and he is just genuinely a very fussy eater. And we didn't really have any issues, but we have always had issues with school. There was always a feeling of she really struggled with school. I mean, from 3, 4, you know. But it's the usual thing, you know, terribly. I mean, I look back now and I go, oh God, the amount of times I forced her in, you know, crying in the playground and teachers taking her off me. Oh God. I mean, I look back now and go, I don't know why I did any of that. But you're made to feel like that's normal and that's okay, which is shocking, really. And then sort of about 8, she started to have quite a lot of anxiety about things. So I noticed over time she started to sort of cut back on food, and her sort of range of food became very beige, bland, you know, kind of these sort of, she'd eat, well, actually it became cold food as well. So she dropped hot food, but it happened so gradually, I didn't really register. I look back now and go, how did I not? But I was obviously worried because I was keeping food diaries. So I still got these food diaries. I was looking at them. I was going, oh gosh, I was obviously really worried. And, you know, you can see that the range of food was just very small. And she lost a lot of weight. But I think because it happened gradually, I didn't notice until I saw a photo of her in a bridesmaid dress. And I could see like her collarbone, like really sticking out. And I went, oh my gosh. And I got these photos and I was like, how have I not noticed this? And so I started to sort of kind of try not to weigh. It's that horrible thing with a girl, like you don't want to weigh them, you don't want it to become a big thing. But I was like, actually I do need to start checking this. And I went to the doctors and I said, I think there's gastro problems, she's getting reflux, she's quite anxious. And he basically looked at her and said, well, she's always been slight, so it's fine, and kind of tried to dismiss. And it was the first time I think I've properly, I mean, I'm like Joe says, I'm like, oh, okay, fine, you know, whatever you say. But I went, I'm not leaving here until you refer her. So I will just sit here until, and it was the first time I kind of put my foot down and went, no, that's not okay. And he very reluctantly referred us to a gastro. So we sort of, from about 8 to about 10, and I look back now in horror at all this, we put her through so many gastro tests. Even an endoscopy, and the guilt, as Joey was saying about, I mean, I just feel terrible because she had like very bad reflux. So we were going down that it must be something. And actually, I do think she has got various kind of sort of sensitivities to various food and stuff like that. So she had celiac tests and various kind of high pylori tests. I can't even remember how many tests she had. And nothing came back. And the only thing they found was a slightly inflamed stomach lining. And I was like, well, okay, that doesn't sound like it's, you know, they were like very dismissive. And she'd had cow protein intolerance as a baby because she'd got gastroenteritis. And I thought, well, maybe it's done some damage to her stomach lining at a very early age. And then around 8, she then started to gradually sort of build her food up again. School was still an issue. She hit sort of year 5 and started to drop out of various things at school. She was starting to have problems sort of interacting with the girls. You know, she dropped sort of doing ballet and acro and various things. And her food just was sort of up and down, really, but kind of okay. She was just very slight. And then we got to sort of year 6 and it just started to fall off a cliff, and she reduced her range of food, she reduced her intake, she hated this teacher at school. I mean, it became a really big thing. She was having problems with the girls, and her food, she just dropped all hot food. She just, like, she said it made her feel too full, and she felt you know, her reflux was quite bad. And we'd gone through the NHS and suddenly the NHS just dropped us because the gastroenterologist went off sick. So we started paying privately. I mean, the cost has been just phenomenal because we've had to just go private. And they took her off all kinds of, they put her on dairy-free, gluten-free, you know, you name it. It was just a nightmare. And nothing seemed to really change. And in the end, they said, we think this is psychological. We think this is sort of, you know. And at that point, I got her a counsellor. And it was this counsellor that then sort of said, look, I think she might have ARFID. So it took an awful long time for us to get to that point. And when she transitioned to secondary school, she went from being in quite a vulnerable position at year six and quite low in weight. She then transitioned in the September. By the October, she was, so like 80% weight for height is kind of a worry, like, and a concern. 70%, you're kind of getting to the, you need to be in hospital. So she dropped to 65%. And we didn't have CAMS. We couldn't get CAMS involved. We were sort of left from the October to the March, where she was critically ill, and we kept on taking her to A&E. They kept on doing checks and saying she's okay, and I was like, I don't understand how she can be okay. I didn't actually know about the medical emergencies and eating disorders document, which had I known about, I'd have probably gone in a bit more informed. And they just kept dismissing, to the point where in the March, it was CAMS finally got involved and they had to intervene. They basically had to get the top paediatrician in within the group to kind of say, she needs to be admitted, she needs an NG tube now. And at that point, I mean, poor Grace had been taken to NE so many times that I was sort of called out of a meeting at work. They were like, get her there now. And she was so scared, she nearly broke the bathroom door because she locked herself in and we couldn't get her out. And it was just horrific. And she didn't trust anyone at this point. You know, they'd completely left her. She had actually been diagnosed with autism, which, again, we had to go private in the September because I knew we were hitting crisis. And I thought, there's just definitely something here. I don't know what it is. And I'd only really started reading about autism in the summer before and went, oh gosh, okay, I can see some of these things. And then she was admitted to hospital, a pediatric ward, for 6 weeks. So I stayed with her. I took an emergency year off work, so I got a career break. And then they tried to feed her in hospital. They were trying to insist on putting her on hospital food. I think they went down the anorexia route of you will eat. And I there was a massive battle at the beginning. I was like, no, this isn't happening. You don't understand ARFID. I need someone that understands ARFID. You can't do that to an ARFID child. She doesn't eat hot food. Why on earth would she eat hospital food? I will bring the food in. So finally they let me bring food in. But I kept on saying to them, she's not going to eat here because it's more stressful. It's not less stressful. Yeah. And in the end, she just didn't eat. I mean, she just literally downed tools and said, and at that point, it was critical. And they said, that's it, you have to have an NG. And actually, she was relieved. It was horrible seeing it go in. It was a horrible experience. But she was very brave and she was really, she named it in the end. You know, it was like it became her friend because it was like, well, thank you, something's helping me. She hated doing the feed and like them putting the pedosure through and everything. But because she was so determined that this isn't what she wanted and she wanted to get out of hospital, she then started eating. So about 3 or 4 weeks in, she said, I want to try food. So we were then making food and bringing it in. And the dietitians around us, bless them, I mean, I just don't think they were trained. So they kept on sort of saying, well, would she eat a quiche? I think they said at one point. I was like, how many people eat quiche? And I was like, no, she wouldn't. She doesn't eat eggs. She doesn't, like, what? So I was a bit like, no. I said, can I just do it? If you tell me calorie-wise what she has to have, because it, you know, behind the scenes. Obviously, I didn't talk to her about that. And I designed things that I said, well, what would you eat, Grace? And then I designed a meal and then we made a meal. And so it was constantly backwards and forwards with my poor husband making all these things at home and bringing them in. And then they transferred her to Great Ormond Street, Mildred Creek unit, which is an inpatient unit, because she's got severe emetophobia. So her fear of being sick was, you know, with late onset, it tends to be anxiety-based, quite often social, you know, something to do with school or interactions with peers. And for her, it became that the emetophobia was a big thing. So she'd seen someone be sick and then she was, it wasn't even her actually, it was someone else. And she then got terrified of being sick. So a bit like Arlo with the choking, it becomes like a block in your mind. If I'm going to do that, I might feel too full and I might be sick. So that's why she was restricting her food. She wanted to keep very small portions so she didn't feel too full. And unfortunately, when you starve yourself like that, you feel too full really quickly. So it becomes a bit of a vicious circle of trying to get through that and get out of that. And she just stopped cognitively functioning, actually. You couldn't rationalize with her and you couldn't get her to engage in any kind of mental health support at that point. Even Cam said, we can't work with her until she's in a better space. And they were right. You know, I kind of was a bit like, oh, they're making excuses. But actually, I look back now and go, yeah, they were right. She just couldn't think at that point. So it's been a rocky road, but I'd say the good thing with it is that once they restored her weight, whilst she's stunted her kind of growth and everything, and obviously she's very small for her age and quite underdeveloped, she has actually made amazing progress. And I think the fear of going back to hospital, which is horrible that that's the reason, means that she carries on eating. And actually, she's gone back to eating quite a wide range of food. But she does have things, you know, she won't eat with us. She doesn't like eating around people. She's still quite sensory. She doesn't like hot food much. She does tend to eat cold food. So she will eat with us every now and again. You know, she says it's like the queen coming to tea. So we sort of kind of make a bit of a sort of joke about it now because it's like, oh, Grace is coming to tea.
Which I think, you know, in the midst of everything, you know, being able to have a little giggle is one of the most healing things, isn't it? Because ultimately it's an awful, horrific thing to go through. And again, like to all of you, I have so many questions. So definitely I think we need to do a follow-up. But something I wanted to ask you was, in terms of, you know, you said that she was at a point where she was very unwell and then had that kind of fear of, I don't want to be in hospital, so I'll eat, which I can imagine was the most, you know, was a very traumatic experience because at the end of the day, the thing that she wanted to do the least was to eat. Do you think that sort of impacted the ARFID at all, of having those sorts of, that sort of traumatic experience of going into the hospital?
I think for her, weirdly, I don't know how much of the actual therapy really worked at Great Ormond Street, but the thing that worked for her was the structure. And I do think she, whenever she feels stressed now and she starts to go off food, like the whole, but I don't want to be back there, there's quite a rational, okay, I'm finding it a little bit hard to eat at the moment, but I know, and she sort of has learned, I know that when I feel stressed, my stomach feels funny. So for her, there was interoception problems. So she can't identify internal feelings. So she couldn't identify hunger and she still struggles with that now. And she gets hangry quite a lot. I have to carry food around because she doesn't seem to know when she's hungry. So she knows that she can't
identify these things. So she sort of accepts that. So I think this is where there is an advantage with an older child. You can start to do the work on, so, okay, so you don't know when you're hungry. So maybe you need to trust that I know when you're hungry and just eat. And she has got to a point now where she says, well, do you think I might be hungry? And I'm like, probably, yes, you haven't eaten for... So you can have that sort of rational kind of conversation, but she just doesn't get the triggers and stuff. So I think, you know, and there is the link to, if I don't eat, I'll go back to hospital. I kind of hate that, because that's that horrible threat of something awful will happen. But she has, and I've always felt guilty. I've always like, could we have managed it at home better? Could we have... But I mean, she was existing off chocolate for like 4 months. That's the only thing I could get her to eat. And it was because she could suck it. And it was, you know, didn't have to sort of chew. And I was like, how would I have? Like, I tried everything. Yeah. I tried the leaving things, like little tasting plates. You know, I did I got advice from nutritionists and, you know, various things. And, you know, they were sort of saying, well, you know, she needs to eat higher fat food and this, that, and the other. And it's like, I just, whatever we bought, whatever, you know, I took her shopping. I was like, you choose things. Like, what do you find? Because she loved cooking. That was the bizarre thing. She would cook a whole meal when she was really ill, but then wouldn't touch it. So she didn't mind that. She would quite happily, like, unlike Ethel, who couldn't have dealt with the smell, she was there cooking, and cooking became a thing. So it was almost like she had an obsession about food. She just couldn't eat it. So I tried everything. I thought, oh, she cooks, she'll eat. Just nothing. Yeah, nothing worked really. So.
Well, and I think from, you know, what you've all described, it just demonstrates how different experiences can be. Yet there's some similar elements, of course, but actually, you know, the differences. But I think, I mean, there's a couple of themes that come out to me in terms of what you've all said, and one of them being sort of the guilt as parents that you feel, but oh my God, the care and compassion and understanding that you have and how much you want to help your children. So if I can say anything, then, like, you know, I think, as I said, you don't know until you know, and you've all done, you know, as much as you possibly can, fought tooth and nail to get your children help. So I wish that we had 4 more hours to talk, because there's so much I want to ask. But as I've said, I am going to ask you if you would like to come on again, because I think, yeah, your experiences could be so helpful for people to hear. So that would be wonderful. But in the meantime, where can people go to find your podcast and listen to you guys talk more?
We're all looking at each other like, who's going to speak? So the podcast is on Spotify and now, isn't it, Joan?
Yes.
Apple too. Yeah. And it's Three Mums, One Mission, ARFID. And we're also on Facebook and Instagram.
Amazing. Well, honestly, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak to you all. And I just don't know where that hour's gone. So I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Thank you for having us. It's been brilliant.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.